This recording of a Sunstone Symposium session is brought to you by Signature Books. This is Steph Larson talking about our new release here at Signature, 13th Apostle, The Diaries of Amasa M. Lyman. For those of you new to Lyman's story, his spiritual journey is fascinating and remarkably familiar to many modern Mormons, especially those of us navigating a non-traditional relationship with the church, which is probably everyone listening to this podcast. Lyman converted to the church in New Hampshire and was actually confirmed a member by Orson Pratt. Joseph Smith calls Lyman to a mission just a few months after his conversion, beginning a long and complex career of church service. When Orson Pratt, the man who introduced Lyman to the church and confirmed him a member, was excommunicated, Lyman was called to serve as an apostle of the church. But when Pratt was rebaptized and restored to his old position, Lyman became the 13th apostle and was treated as a fifth wheel by church leadership. Brigham Young restored Lyman as an apostle after Joseph Smith's death, and Lyman follows him to Salt Lake. Young later calls him to the presidency of the church's European mission, and that's where things start to get weird. In Scotland, Lyman gives a sermon in Dundee where he suggests that Jesus' mission was primarily to teach truth, rather than to die for sins. Now, this is stuff that Young himself had speculated about in the past, and yet Lyman is brought in for a joint meeting with the First Presidency and the Quorum of the Twelve to account for his views. Lyman is immediately apologetic and issues a public statement in the Deseret News admitting to his grievous sin. Eventually, though, he can't reconcile his personal beliefs with those of the Brethren and gives a more radical version of the Dundee sermon here in Utah, and he is immediately excommunicated. So, what were Lyman's heretical beliefs? In the Dundee sermon, he states, "Did Jesus go about seeking to procure his own death that the world might benefit by it? No. Did he know that such would be his fate? Yes. What I find fault with is that when we are told the blood of Jesus will cleanse us from all sin without any effort on our part to do right, it is virtually a proclamation to us that we can do nothing for ourselves, and then we will sit down supinely, waiting for the blood of Jesus to free us from the consequences of the wrongs we are committing." That sounds pretty Mormon to me, right? In fact, let's compare what Lyman says with what church leaders currently teach. In April 2008, Elder Nelson gave a conference talk titled Salvation and Exaltation, where he more or less says the same thing as Lyman. Resurrection, or immortality, comes to every man and every woman as an unconditional gift. Eternal life, or celestial glory or exaltation, is a conditional gift. Conditions of this gift have been established by the Lord, who said, "If you keep my commandments and endure to the end, you shall have eternal life," which gift is the greatest of all the gifts of God. Those qualifying conditions include faith in the Lord, repentance, baptism, receiving the Holy Ghost, and remaining faithful to the ordinances and covenants of the temple. Lyman is excommunicated and eventually turns to spiritualism as a means of maintaining a relationship with divinity. The spiritualist movement, which believes spirits of the dead can communicate and advise the living, offered Lyman a way to remain true to his beliefs in human perfectibility while maintaining a connection to the beliefs he treasured in Mormonism. Lyman conducted several seances toward the end of his life, communicating with his children, as well as his friend Joseph Smith, who, naturally, assured him that someday the saints would accept the new movement of spiritualism. I found Lyman's seances with his children particularly touching and, again, very, very familiar to modern Mormons. Mormons believe in an afterlife and in the preservation of the family unit after death. While seances conjure up images of Ouija boards and candles, Lyman's seances create a vision of an afterlife very much in line with the Mormon belief in eternal families living together in celestial happiness. In one seance, Lyman speaks with his daughter Ruth, who died at age 4. She speaks to Lyman through his living daughter, Hilla, saying, "My dear Pa and Ma, I have come to tell you about my home and spirit life. I live with Grandma and Grandpa part of the time. When I am not with them, I live with Richard in a pretty little cottage with a beautiful garden and fruit trees. I have rose bushes in my flower garden. I call them my own. I have birds, but I don't keep them in cages. I let them go free, and when they are tired of being on wing, they come to their trees and flowers and rest." I can think of nothing more Mormon than a father seeking out his family in the afterlife to make sure they are safe and happy and cared for. I imagine Lyman's belief that spiritualism offered him continued relationships with friends and loved ones eased the pain of excommunication from the church he served diligently. At the end of his life, Lyman is buried in his black work clothes, according to his wishes and against the wishes of his wife, who wants him buried in the robes of the priesthood. It's a simple act that testifies of Lyman's devotion to truth no matter where he finds it, as a convert, as a missionary, an apostle, and as a spiritualist. 13th Apostle is available on Amazon in both print and Kindle editions, and if you are in Salt Lake, it is available at several local bookstores, including Benchmark Books.
You're listening to the Sunstone Podcast by the Sunstone Education Foundation, bringing you quality discussions surrounding Mormonism from the recorded audio from our past summer symposiums. Sunstone brings you over 40 years of engaging, thoughtful discussions around Mormonism. Check us out on iTunes under Sunstone Magazine, visit our website at sunstone.org, and join us for our many conferences and events. This session is 174 from the 2013 Summer Symposium in Salt Lake City, titled Mysticism, Revelation and Leadership in Mormon History, Two Case Studies.
I think we're going to begin the panel today. It's Mysticism, Revelation, and Leadership in Mormon History, Two Case Studies. The first paper we're going to have is by Chris Smith. Chris is a PhD student in religions in North America at Claremont Graduate University. He's writing a dissertation on Mormons and American Indians in the Age of Removal, which roughly coincided with the lifetime of Joseph Smith. Chris has published on Mormon-related subjects in journals such as Dialogue and Sunstone. He's going to be presenting a paper on J. Dunham Lamanite, early Mormon leader, mystic, and Indian ambassador. And then we're going to have Claire Barris. Who manages several church history sites, including Today in Mormon History, blogspot.com. He blogs at Worlds Without Ends and has presented papers at Sunstone Mormon History Association and the BYU Mormon Media Studies Symposium. And his paper is going to be on the Lawless Women Revelation. And then we're going to have Elise Boxer responding to these papers. She received her PhD from Arizona State University in History. She's an associate instructor in ethnic studies at the University of Utah. And she grew up on the Fort Peck
Assiniboine.
Assiniboine.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry.
No, that's fine.
I'm terrible at phonics. And Sioux Reservation in Poplar, Montana, and is Sessentum. Okay, I'm sorry.
I'll introduce myself.
Okay, yeah. And she, her research examines Mormon colonialism and racial formations as manifested by Mormon whiteness and Mormon identity. And then we'd encourage each presenter to introduce themselves if they would like to as well. So here we go with Chris.
Jonathan Dunham is rarely remembered in the history books, but he should be. He was an entrepreneur, a faith healer, a prolific missionary. He was a leader of the Danites, the Nauvoo Legion, and the Nauvoo Police. He was a key member of Joseph Smith's inner circle at Nauvoo. He was theologically creative, religiously zealous, personally charismatic, and institutionally important in the LDS Church. He was also a conscientious record keeper who left behind four journals, an account book, some letters, and assorted other papers. So he was not, in other words, the kind of person that historians can afford to ignore. In this presentation, I'm going to share three vignettes or three episodes from Jonathan Dunham's life. And each of these vignettes reveals a different facet of his personality and his significance in early Mormon history. I was a little torn as I was composing this paper because these three vignettes don't really fit together to tell a single coherent story. But I decided, who really cares about being coherent when you can be interesting? So, insofar as
some of us do.
Insofar as there is a common theme here, I suppose it's just that Jonathan Dunham deserves more attention than he gets. Or maybe even that we should pay more attention to biography in general because it can shed so much light on early Mormon history in the broader sense. Or maybe, insofar as there's a common theme, maybe the common theme is that there is no common theme. Because individual lives are often complicated affairs that don't lend themselves to easy summation in 30-minute presentations. But regardless of what you take away from this presentation, I hope that you will at least find the three stories that I have to tell interesting, be intrigued by them, and maybe learn something from them. The first vignette that I'll share is about Dunham's participation in the 1838 migration of Mormons from Kirtland to Missouri, which is known as Kirtland Camp. In the winter of 1837 and 1838, Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon were driven out of Kirtland and fled to Missouri. Smith and Rigdon's exit sparked a mass exodus of Mormon believers from Kirtland, with an estimated 2,000 or so people striking out from Missouri that winter. Those who remained in Kirtland come springtime, including Jonathan Dunham, were largely the poor. These were people who didn't have the resources to make the journey on their own. So when the remaining members of the Quorum of the 70 decided to put their resources together, pool their resources, and migrate as a quorum to Missouri, they started getting all of these applications from ordinary poor members who wanted to come along. And being probably too generous-hearted for their own good, the 70s agreed to let these people come. Before they knew it, the 70s had a company of over 500 saints who wanted to go west to Missouri with them, and they had very little in the way of money or supplies to feed all of these people. And migrating together like this in a big group was problematic because when you have a group of this size, you can't really forage or beg enough along the way to feed all of these people. You also have to worry about epidemics of disease because the bigger the group, the more sort of potential there is for contagion to spread, more vectors of infection, if you will. But there were spiritual manifestations that seemed to confirm that all of this was God's will, including a vision of an angel that was seen by Jonathan Dunham and by a couple other people at the same time. Signs in the heavens. And so the 70s decided they were going to make a covenant that they would go together and they would not leave anyone behind who wanted to go. Depending on your perspective, this was either very foolish or very sort of heroic act of faith. Maybe it was a little bit of both. But for present purposes, the important thing for my narrative is that Jonathan Dunham was the guy the Council of the 70 put in charge of this mess. And he actually managed to do a pretty good job of it. Officially, Dunham wasn't the company's leader. He was the camp engineer. The official leaders were the seven presidents of the Council of the 70. But however unprestigious the title of engineer may sound, his responsibilities were actually so broad that there seems to have been a general understanding that he was the leader of this expedition. He was heading up this expedition. People described him as our leader in their journals. And among his responsibilities as camp engineer, he was in charge of scouting ahead of the company, charting the course, procuring supplies, maintaining the marching order, and arranging the camp's defense every night, arranging the wagons and choosing the sentries and so forth. Several of these responsibilities he delegated to assistants who he managed, which kept him free during the day for his chief responsibility, which was to literally lead the company by riding ahead of the company and scouting for sources of water and forage and purchasing supplies before the local merchants had a chance to hike their prices. And these duties posed quite a challenge because there were constant supply shortages, constant sickness, constant conflict with people along the trail. But ultimately, Dunham managed to get most of the camp safely to its destination. One interesting aspect of Dunham's leadership of this group is that he probably, from this experience, learned a lot of the skills that later served him as a military officer in Missouri and Nauvoo, including how to lead and inspire people, how to manage logistics, and even how to practice a little subterfuge when necessary for the security of the community. For example, at one point during the journey, he infiltrated a group of anti-Mormons who were looking at some Kirtland banknotes and planning to sort of waylay the company with legal action. They were going to arrest some of the leaders. And these men, apparently, Dunham engaged these guys in conversation, had a good chat with them, and they never even suspected that he was a Mormon. And it was probably because of these demonstrated leadership skills, his sort of demonstrated ability to do this kind of thing, that he was, when he arrived in Missouri, he was not only immediately initiated into the Danite organization, but he was immediately promoted to the rank of captain. And so while I'm sure that no one in Kirtland Camp would have guessed it at the time, what they were witnessing during this journey was the making of a Danite, the making of a military leader. In addition to his management of the camp's temporal affairs, Dunham also contributed spiritual leadership. And he especially stands out for his practice of faith healing during the journey. Sickness and injury were constant troubles on the trail, and they weren't stopping for people when people got sick. They weren't stopping. And so faith healing played a very important role during the journey in sort of giving people the will to go on. Samuel Tyler describes once just sitting down on the side of the trail and just being unable to even move, unable to speak, and then someone comes along and lays hands on him, and he's able to get up and walk again until the end of the day. So that's the sort of function that faith healing served, and Dunham was very successful at this, multiple successful healings during the course of the journey, and he really acquired a reputation as the leader of the camp who had the most faith that people were going to be healed. And John D. Lee later described him as the most faithful Mormon who ever lived. One of the most spectacular incidents on the trail occurred when Dunham and a couple other leaders were arrested for alleged involvement in the Kirtland Bank fiasco, which wasn't true. He wasn't involved. But that night, as they were in prison, they emulated Paul and Silas from the New Testament by singing hymns out through the window of their cell. And many of the town's residents stood at their doorways and windows to listen to the singing. And then later that night, as Dunham was lying awake thinking about his predicament, he experienced an angelic visitation. The cell was suddenly filled with light, and he received a testimony that they would be released at the same hour the next day. This was at midnight, and the following day, as the bell struck noon, they were released by the judge. And later that day, the prisoners caught up with the rest of the company, and they were greeted with tears and jubilation. This was really one of Dunham's shining moments, and I think that it beautifully illustrates his religious devotion and charisma. And this was a guy for whom the biblical God of miracles was alive and still very active in the world. The second vignette that I'm going to share has to do with Dunham's efforts to evangelize the American Indians. Dunham was a huge champion of the Indian mission, probably because his patriarchal blessing really placed a lot of stress on this theme. And he dedicated a major portion of his life to this endeavor. This vignette comes from 1840, as Dunham was passing through Kirtland on his way to evangelize the Indians of New York. As Dunham approached Kirtland, he sent a letter ahead to a friend to announce that he was coming. And in his letter and some of the sermons that he preached after he arrived in Kirtland, he sort of laid out the vision that was driving his Indian missionary efforts. The content of his letter and preaching are described in a letter by Thomas Burdick, who wrote to Joseph Smith because he was so alarmed by what Dunham had said. He was basically writing to just Joseph Smith to say, is this guy for real? You know, like, is this authorized? Unfortunately, we don't have Joseph Smith's response, but I think the answer is this guy was for real, because several of the things that he says track with things that we know Joseph Smith said from other sources. So it really does seem like the ideas that he was expressing were largely ideas that he had acquired from Smith, and the calling to go to the Indians was something that Joseph Smith had given him. So I'm going to describe for you some of the ideas that he laid out, because I think they illuminate a lot of what the Mormons were thinking about racial theology in the early Indian mission. The things that most alarmed Burdick were the political dimensions of Dunham's teaching and the Indian mission. Dunham stressed the urgency of his mission because, as he put it, a new scene of things were about to transpire in the West in fulfillment of prophecy. He said the United States was going to be destroyed, and the saints were going to take refuge in a place of safety toward the Rocky Mountains. And the implication here is that he was going to the Indians in order to enlist them in the construction of such a place of safety in the West. And I think that probably people were also, the Gentiles who heard these things, were inferring that maybe he was going to the Indians to get them to help in bringing about the destruction of the United States. So it's no wonder that when a Universalist preacher from Kirtland read Dunham's letter, he was heard to remark, "The Mormons ought to be seen to," which is a rather strong sentiment for a Universalist preacher. In addition to the in addition to revealing the political dimensions of the Indian mission, Dunham's letter and his preaching also help us understand some of the theological underpinnings of the mission. In his letter, he laid out a strongly literalistic interpretation of the biblical prophecies about the restoration of Israel. And this, by the way, I think was one of the core ideas of Mormonism from the beginning. Many Protestants had sort of metaphorized these prophecies. They had abandoned the idea of a literal restoration of Israel, but the Mormons strongly stressed that this restoration was going to be literally, the Indians were literally Israel, and there was also going to be a literal restoration of the Lost Ten Tribes. And my most fun example of this from Dunham's letter is, or rather from one of his sermons in Kirtland, was he taught that the Lost Ten Tribes were on a detached planet that had once been affixed to the Earth's North Pole, and that this planet was eventually going to return, and the Earth was going to reel to and fro as this planet reattached to the North Pole. This is the earliest, but certainly not the only attestation of this very fun teaching, which other sources actually attribute to Joseph Smith, so I think it's fully possible that this came directly from Joseph Smith. The teaching isn't really about Indians, but I think it underscores the commitment that early Mormons felt to the literalism of the restoration of Israel, and even the literalism of the scriptures more generally, because I think that one of the sources of this teaching is D&C 8845, which says, "The earth rolls upon her wings." And the suggestion here seems to be that the earth literally had wings, these secondary spheres attached to the North and South Pole along its rotational axis. So it's rolling on its wings. And that one of these spheres has detached and will reattach when the lost tribes return. An even more interesting aspect of the letter that Dunham sent to Kirtland is that he signed it J. Dunham Lamanite. And this is fascinating because he doesn't seem to have actually had any Indian ancestry. So why is he calling himself a Lamanite? And I think probably the answer is rooted in the Book of Mormon. I'm not going to go into all the details of this, but basically there's several Book of Mormon verses that say that if the Gentiles repent and if they help the Indians come in and get restored and build a new Jerusalem, then the Gentiles are going to be numbered among the seed of Jacob, the son of Lehi. Not the Jacob of the Old Testament, but Jacob, the son of Lehi. So I think the sense maybe that Dunham has is that by helping the Lamanites, he's going to be numbered among the Lamanites. And there may even be a sense of sort of racial transformation, because Joseph Smith taught a doctrine that when you convert, when you're baptized, the old Gentile blood is supernaturally purged out of your body and replaced with Israelite blood. And so there may even have been a sense that he's been literally transformed into a Lamanite by virtue of his repentance and his participation in the Indian mission. The third vignette that I'm going to share has to do with what happened when Joseph Smith was imprisoned in the Carthage jail in the days before his martyrdom. And to be honest, I'm including this one mainly because if people know anything about Jonathan Dunham, they know this story. Which is that Mike Quinn, a historian who's at this conference, has argued that Joseph Smith was so frightened of being murdered in the Carthage jail that he secretly ordered Jonathan Dunham, who was then the acting major general in the Carthage jail, in the Nauvoo Legion, the acting major general being the second rank after Joseph Smith himself in the Nauvoo Legion, Quinn says that these secret orders were to bring the Legion to Carthage, make a military assault on Carthage, and rescue Joseph Smith from the jail. And that Dunham, knowing this would cause a bloodbath, ignored the order and chose not to tell anyone about it. Unfortunately, one of the major sources that Quinn relied on when he first laid out the case for this turned out to be a forgery by Mark Hoffman. But there are other sources that suggest this, and Quinn stands by his interpretation of this. I think that people have kind of stayed away from it because of the association with a Hoffman forgery. But I want to take this on. I want to ask the question, how good is Quinn's evidence for this, and did Smith really give Dunham secret orders? My answer is that Quinn's evidence is decent, but not a slam dunk. A couple of the sources he's misinterpreted, which I won't go into because I don't really have time, but those sources basically are not relevant. So that leaves three sources that seem to support Quinn's claim. The first two are Alan Joseph Stout's reminiscences, his autobiography and reminiscences, and an 1873 book by T.B.H. Stenhouse. These authors both reported that while in the jail, Smith wrote an official order to Jonathan Dunham to bring the Legion and reserve him from being killed. The idea is the order was to protect Joseph Smith, but it doesn't specify a military assault. And it doesn't specify rescuing him from the jail, even, which is interesting, which I'll get to in a moment. But these sources also say that Dunham disregarded the order and didn't tell anyone that he'd received it. So these seem to support Quinn's narrative. And these two accounts are partially corroborated by a third source, which says that when Joseph's jailer told him that a mob was approaching, Joseph replied, "Don't trouble yourself, they have come to rescue me." This doesn't necessarily mean that Joseph had ordered the Legion to come, but it does suggest that he was at least expecting or hoping for his followers to make some kind of rescue attempt. The problem with the Stout and Stenhouse story is that it was written long after the fact, and it has the ring of a rumor. In fact, we may even be able to pinpoint where this rumor originated. On June 27th, which was the day that Joseph Smith was murdered, in the hours before the murder, Willard Richards came out of the Carthage jail with a letter for Joseph Smith's lawyer, instructing the lawyer to come and organize Smith's defense. And Richards handed the letter to Dan Jones, who was outside the jail, and asked him to deliver it to Quincy, which is where the lawyer was. But when the mob outside the jail saw this letter be handed to Jones, some claimed that it was orders for the Nauvoo Legion to come there and save the prisoners. The mob demanded that Jones turn over the letter, which he refused, and they fired at him as he rode away. If the mob circulated this rumor of secret orders, some of the Mormon faithful may have seized upon the story for different reasons, which is that it made the prophet seem to have anticipated his murder and taken some kind of action to prevent it, if only his followers hadn't failed him, which is what you would expect from a prophet. So maybe this was sort of a Gentile rumor that was seized upon by the faithful for their own reasons. Still, Alan Joseph Stout was a Nauvoo Danite, and, a Nauvoo policeman, which was sort of the Nauvoo version of the Danites. And therefore, he would have known Dunham, who was also a Nauvoo policeman, and he would have had access to secret information. And so, maybe he's a reliable source for this. More importantly, I found an additional source, which was overlooked by Glenn, which I think may even be more important. And the source in question is John D. Lee, who said this. He said, quote, "Dunham said that the prophet requested him to take his command and ambush it in a grove near Carthage and watch the movements of the crowd, but Dunham dared not go contrary to the orders of the governor." This may actually be the most important evidence of all, because Lee not only directly cites Dunham as the source of his information, therefore giving this information a respectable provenance, but also provides a more plausible account of what the Legion's orders actually were. Apart from Smith's remark to the jailer that they have come to rescue me, none of the other sources that I've quoted here suggest that the orders were actually to rescue Joseph. The orders The Stout and Stenhouse sources just say that the orders were to protect Joseph from being killed. And Lee's account suggests that the exact content of the orders was to clandestinely guard the jail, not to break Joseph out of it. Lee's statement also casts Smith's instructions as strictly verbal, whereas Stout and Stenhouse suggest that the orders were written. And so maybe there weren't actually any written orders. In fact, something this incriminating, you wouldn't think that you would write it down. They were smarter than that. So if Dunham really did receive such instructions from Smith, it probably wasn't moral qualms that prevented him from obeying these orders. On the morning of June 26th, probably the orders would have been given June 25th, the evening of June 25th, or the morning of June 26th. But on the morning of June 26th, an officer of the state militia arrived in Nauvoo with an armed force, and this officer of the state militia officially took command of the Nauvoo Legion. So Dunham was now subordinate to this state militia officer, legally speaking. And this armed force from the state militia remained in Nauvoo through the following day when Joseph Smith was murdered. So if Dunham had opted to violate the governor's orders and to go and guard the jail, as he may have been ordered to do, he would have had to usurp command of the Legion and possibly fight this armed force that was entrenched there in Nauvoo. And so it may just not have seemed feasible to him to do this. If there's a lesson to be learned from this third vignette, it may be less about Jonathan Dunham or Joseph Smith than about humility as we approach the past. Interpreting the past is hard, especially when we're talking about secrets, because secrets attract a lot of speculation but very little illumination. And in this case, I think that maybe there were secret instructions. I think there's some good evidence that there were, but I don't think it's a slam dunk. The Lee source is a little bit suspect because it passed through an editor. And there's another version of it that makes it sound a little bit more like a rumor and a little bit less like a direct information from Dunham. And so it's a little bit dubious, but if there were orders, then I think that we can at least safely say that the secret probably wasn't quite as dark as Quinn has made it out to be. It was probably the orders were to guard the jail rather than to assault Carthage and rescue Smith from the jail. Thank you.
We're going to now hear from Claire about lawless women, the lawless women revolution.
Before I start, I'm just curious, of you women out there, how many of you consider yourself to be lawless? Yeah, all right, I see some lawless women. And you guys, how many of you have a lawless woman in your life? Okay, all right. So I think you'll relate with this. This paper is kind of like the Girls Gone Wild version of Mormon history. It's women gone lawless. So all right. Not long after his death, next slide, please. Not long after his death, a book used for record keeping by Heber C. Kimball was found by his family. It contained records such as items received while crossing the plains, baptismal and ordinance dates, genealogical information, and so on. Towards the end of the book, an important discovery was made, titled H.C. Kimball's Memorandum. It was used by Heber C. Kimball to record a series of revelations received between 1852 and 1864. Referring to the memorandum book, his son noted, quote, after father died, we found in a blank book where he had jotted down some of the things that the Lord had told him, close quote. Next slide. Stay right there, actually. Yeah, that's good. Heber C. Kimball was an early convert to the church, soon becoming a member of the original Quorum of the Twelve, and eventually a member of the First Presidency as a counselor to his good friend Brigham Young. He was a very charismatic person, seeing his first vision at the age of 9, reporting visions, revelations, signs in the heavens, and other spiritual manifestations throughout his life. Most of the 16 revelatory items in his memorandum book were prophetic in nature, giving predictions of future events. And these revelations predicted a division of states between the North and the South, when the occupying soldiers of Johnston's army would leave, a period of sickness and mourning, two revelations about the U.S. making war with the church, that he would be blessed among the saints, that he would be favored by Brigham Young above all others, that the U.S. would be rejected, would reject the church's petition for statehood, that Kimball could have an additional 25 years of life if he desired, and several revelations predicting that Kimball would be lifted up while sorrow would befall first a fellow First Presidency counselor, Daniel H. Wells. Only three of the items in the book were not prophetic in nature, and all of them have the same date, February 3rd, 1852. On that date, he was told that he had fulfilled the law of lawless women, and because he had fulfilled that law, he would be free from such spirits. The revelation noted that now that he was free from these spirits, his time would be devoted to those who were obedient and would listen to him. The text of the revelation is as follows. My son Heber, he shall devote his entire time to the cause of God and to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and he shall not be under the law of lawless women any more in time, as he has fulfilled the law and is now free from such spirits. And the set time shall be devoted to the humble and obedient and those that shall listen. This curious revelation raises a number of questions. Who were the lawless women? What law had they fulfilled? Or had Kimball fulfilled? How was he free from the spirits? And what sort of spirits were these? I hope to shed some light on these questions by looking at the context of this revelation, other documents that are related, dating, and mid-19th century Mormon theology to provide a broader understanding of this revelation. One of the other items on the same date is a very short, is in faded pencil, and kind of hard to make out. It says, Mr. K shall devote his entire time. And that's all it says. Note this item and the previously mentioned entry addressed Heber C. Kimball, followed by the same text, shall devote his entire time. It is unclear why there is no additional text. Perhaps the aborted text of this entry was Kimball's first attempt to record this revelation. The third item, with the same date, also discusses lawless women and shares text with the first two items. The revelation begins differently, with the Spirit said that I should, rather than my son Heber, he shall, or Mr. K shall. Hereafter, I will refer to these three items by their first two words. The shortest as the Mr. K version on the screen. The medium-sized item as the My Son version, which was the first one I shared with you. And the longest as the My Spirit version. This entry, the My Son version, continues in Heber's voice, while the other two are in the voice of the Lord. This version also contains the most text, continuing where the My Son version ends. The additional text also contains information that helps better understand what the revelation is about. And this is the additional text. Those who shall listen to my counsel and shall have faith in my counsel and shall listen to his law, for he is my servant, and I will stand by him, and those that will not build him up shall not prosper. I mean those of his house shall not prosper, and peace shall be not be with them, and they shall see sorrow except they repent. Heber C. Kimball. The My Son version is entirely in the voice of the Lord, but the My Spirit version begins in Heber's voice, but changes from Heber's voice to that of the Lord's just after the additional text is included. The additional text in the My Spirit version of the Revelation provides clues as to who the lawless women might be. The phrase, those of this house, indicate the problems likely occurred in his household. These women in his house apparently would quote, would not, quote, listen to his law, unquote, unquote, and would not, quote, build him up, close quote. This suggests that the lawless women were disobedient wives who were not humble and who would not listen to their husband Heber. Heber C. Kimball has been called the most married man in the modern Western world. He was introduced to the principle of plural marriage by Joseph Smith in the summer of 1841, when Joseph Smith asked to marry Kimball's wife, Violet. After several anxious days, Heber and Violet agreed to Joseph Smith's proposal. However, Smith told them that it was only a test, and the marriage did not occur. Kimball married his first plural wife in 1842. In the fall of 1844, after Joseph Smith's death, he married 11 more wives. Three more in the late winter, 22 in the winter of 1845-46, one in 1848, and after nearly an eight-year break, four in 1856, and the last in 1857, for a total of 43 wives. I think that's 43, not counting his first non-plural wife. 43 or 44, I need to recount. It's hard to keep track. Kimball's most productive period of marrying occurred in the winter of 1845-46, when he added 22 wives. 19 of those marriages occurred during a two-week period of time, beginning on January 26, 1846. But three of those days were particularly intense. On February 3rd, he married 10 women. The following day, he married two more wives, and the day following, five more. No details are available about the honeymoon. Kimber received his lawless women revelation on the sixth anniversary of the day that he married 10 women. So this may be an important date. The day he married the most women is the day that he has the revelation 6 years later. Not much imagination is needed to surmise that managing such a large household would have its share of problems. A grandson noted that Kimball, quote, was often heard to declare that the plural order of marriage with its manifold cares and perplexity had cost him a bushel of tears, close quote. In the 9 months previous to the revelation, he had divorced twice, and he would go through a separation and a divorce in the next 2 months. Eventually, a total of 16 wives would leave him. Mormonism incorporated a hierarchical, patriarchal approach to how church and family were viewed. For example, 2 months after receiving the lawless women revelation, Kimball preached, "Some have said that I was very presumptuous to say that Brother Brigham was my God and Savior, and that Brother Joseph was his God." This hierarchical model extended into the home, for example, referring to Jesus' statement, "If you love me, keep my commandments," Kimball said, "If you love brothers Brigham, Heber, and Jedediah, the first presidency, and the 12, please keep our commandments, that they are given to you from day to day, and you will be blessed and exalted. I do not want a woman," that is one of his wives, "to tell me that she loves me when she does not keep my commandments. For her statement would be vague and foolish." This statement assumes a hierarchical priority where church members are obedient to the commandments of church leaders and wives are obedient to the commandments of their husbands. Kimball's wives would receive exaltation through his priesthood, while he, in turn, would be saved by Brigham Young, who would be saved by Joseph Smith, and so on. Another time, Kimball spoke of the importance of hierarchical roles in maintaining happiness, hinting at some of his own marital difficulties. "Now suppose that my wife and children would take the same course to please me and be subject to me, as I am to Brother Brigham. Would there be any sorrow or confusion or broils? No, there would be no sorrow. There would be no blues in my family. I am never blue when I do Brother Brigham's will. But when I do it not, I begin to grow blue." Just as he began marrying 22 of his wives in the winter of 1845, he addressed the holy order, or those who had been endowed, about marriage covenants. He spoke of the necessity of women being in subjection to their husbands. I am subject to my God, my wife is in subjection to me, and will reverence me in my place, and I will make her happy. I do not want her to step forward and dictate to me any more than I dictate to President Young. As a part of the LDS temple ritual, women covenanted to obey the law of their husbands. This concept continued to be taught in LDS discourse into the modern era and was part of the temple endowment until 1990. Since then, I think it was 90. Since then, the teaching has been softened. Men are to preside in their home, and in the temple, women promise to hearken to the counsel of their husbands, while men make no such covenant to their wives. In fact, Kimball may have made reference to temple covenants when he wrote his first wife, Violet, in 1849. As one who had been anointed, Kimball told his wife to teach your sisters, that is, her fellow plural wives, to mind their own business and to treat their husband with respect, and let my husband alone, or let my business alone, and hold their tongues when they want to speak evil to me. Kimball's revelation pointed out a reversal in the hierarchical structure. He shall not be under the law of lawless women anymore. Kimball felt his wives should obey his law, but according to the revelation, some of his wives were lawless and would not follow their husband's law. He was subjected to them rather than they being subjected to him. Now that he had fulfilled their law, or in other words, endured them disobeying or dictating to him, he was free to ignore them while remaining devoted to the, quote, humble and obedient, close quote, wives. Now, note the term in time in this text. He shall not be under the law of lawless women anymore in time. This phrase may suggest that even though his relationship with these wives was ending in this life, they would continue on in eternity. Some marriages were designated for time only, meaning that marriages were valid in this life only, while eternal marriages were valid in the next life. In 1857, Kimball proposed a possible dialogue that might occur upon his death when meeting Joseph Smith in the spirit world. Here we are, Brother Joseph. We are here ourselves, are we not, with none of the property we possessed in our probationary state, not even the rings on our fingers? He will say to us, come along, my boys, where are your wives? They are back yonder, they would not follow us. Never mind, says Joseph, here are thousands. Have all you want. Perhaps the revelation gave Kimball permission to end some of his time-only marriages in divorce or separation, or ignore some of his time and eternity wives until the next life, while freeing up more of his time to devote to the church. The memorandum book is a treasure trove, providing a look at over a dozen of the personal prophecies and revelations of a member of the First Presidency. Of all the revelations in his memorandum book, Kimball put more time and effort into the lawless women revelation than any other. With three versions, we get a glimpse of the process of articulating revelation. One of the memorandum prophecies was given through the Lord Rod, a rod Kimball used to receive revelations. Kimball received a 3.5-foot rod from Joseph Smith in 1842, through which he received at least 10 revelations. His son noted, quote, anything that was his right to know, all he had to do was kneel down with the rod in his hand, and that sometimes the Lord would answer his question before he had time to ask them, close quote. While it is not stated, it is possible that Kimball used his rod to receive the lawless women revelation. We can see this revelation taking form through various versions. The earliest attempt at dictating the revelation was aborted partway through the first sentence. His relationship with the Lord was formal and distant, as he was addressed as Mr. K. The My Son version is probably the next version of the Revelation, which shares the phrase, shall devote his entire time, with the Mr. K version, but is omitted in the My Spirit version. So the first two share similar text. It's omitted in the third version. The My Son version is written cryptically and metaphorically, with his wives referred to as spirits rather than wives. And in this version, Kimball is addressed warmly by the Lord as My Son. The Spirit version is the longest of the three. The voice is that of Kimball's, who says the Spirit had told him these things. There's additional text where the previous version ends. Here the voice shifts back to the first-person voice of the Lord. The text was apparently added to help explain the cryptic text above. It may be that Kimball received this revelation as he pondered the anniversary of his wedding to 10 wives in the Nauvoo Temple 6 years earlier, and the corresponding difficulties that had ensued. He found happiness by strictly following Brigham Young as if Young were his God. Kimball felt his wives would find happiness through strict obedience to him. Summary. The theology introduced by Joseph Smith and defined by Brigham Young defined a hierarchical, patriarchal framework as the objective for Latter-day Saints. Young saw the accumulation of wives and their subsequent progeny as a way to add glory and increase to one's kingdom. Kimball engaged in this celestial ideal on earth and embraced plural marriage more than any other man. However, his attempt to live this form of marriage did not produce a heavenly family on earth. Too many of his wives were independent-minded, probably feminist types, and wanting more say in how their lives were directed, and perhaps wanted more attention from their largely absent husband. 10 years earlier, Kimball had faith that had been severely tried when Joseph Smith asked for his wife and daughter's hand in marriage. But he remained true and faithfully embraced the principle, practicing it with a vengeance. Now he was tried again in the practical implementation of plural marriage. He sought God's blessing to avoid the sorrow he felt in his complex family, getting divine permission to ignore all but his humble and obedient wives. For those whom God said he could now ignore, he predicted sorrow for the lawless women of his family.
Now we'll hear from Elise.
I don't like talking into a mic. My name is Elise Boxer, and as was mentioned earlier, I'm Dakota from the Sisseton and Wahpeton Bands, and that's located in northeastern Montana on the Fort Peck Sioux and Assiniboine Reservation.
Are you speaking to the mic, please?
Louder?
Yeah, that's better.
Okay. Sorry. This is just awkward for me. I have my PhD in history, and being Dakota, that's kind of the perspective I'm going to be writing in response to the two papers today. And that first, typically what I like to do when I do presentations is, one, acknowledge the indigenous people that made this their homeland. And that includes, obviously, the Utes, the Goshutes, and the Paiutes, and even Shoshones. So I first like to acknowledge that this is their indigenous lands, and that they continue to make this their home. So again, it's a privilege to comment on these two papers, and my comments are largely going to be based on the two papers that were emailed to me earlier. And I'm going to start with the first presentation, Christopher Smith's J. Dunham, Lay Nemanite, Early Mormon Leader, Mystic, and Indian Ambassador. So Smith attempts to explore the life of Jonathan Dunham, an individual he believes that historians have largely ignored. He argues that Dunham's life would greatly enrich our understanding of early Mormon history, which is evident in the three vignettes he chose to share with us. One, I would encourage Smith to find a common thread that ties these three stories together beyond them just being interesting. I think our role as scholars is to, you know, to highlight why is this important for us to learn. What do they tell us about Dunham? Or within a larger framework, what do we learn about leaders within the LDS Church as it is a young church beginning to grow and expand into the American West? So the first vignette, while interesting, should be contextualized beyond Mormon history. What makes Dunham's story compelling or important? The second vignette must also be contextualized. Smith references the Mormon use of Lamanites to refer to American Indians, but does little to provide any background history. And this is something I always encourage people to do, is provide definitions for terms that you're using. So if we're using the term Lamanite, what does that specifically refer to? Are we basing it on the Book of Mormon? And that changes when the title changes, as well as American Indians may be descendants, when before it said American Indians are descendants to the people in the Book of Mormon. The other thing is that why is this history important when discussing missionary efforts towards American Indians? Specifically, and how does that relate to religious ideology or within the Book of Mormon as Lamanites as a fallen people, and that they must then accept Mormonism to regain their glory? Dunham makes a concerted effort to preach to indigenous peoples in New York and how this caused tensions between Mormons and non-Mormons. Smith specifically mentions that, and this is something he did towards the end of the presentation, this, quote, incident is important because it reveals the political dimensions of the Lamanite mission, which was all tied up with prophecies about the destruction of America and the construction of a city or kingdom in the West that Mormons and Indians would share, end quote. So again, I encourage you to push this analysis further beyond the Mormon perspective. What does this prophecy say, or this revelation say, in terms of providing the necessary justification for the removal of indigenous people in the United States and then into what was now known or then known as the Indian Territory? And then more importantly, how does this collide with indigenous perspectives? So what are indigenous perspectives, and how can that be included? And then how then does that change the narrative? And more importantly, how does this fit into the larger U.S. history or the larger U.S. colonial project of either the removal of indigenous peoples to the West, either the assimilation policies, and that included religious assimilation of indigenous people? And then finally, you end your essay with a discussion of Dunham's claim to Lamanite identity, and I'd like you to kind of complicate that further, and I would actually suggest the use or the reading of Philip DeLoria's work, Plain Indian, because what he does within that text is that he explores how and why non-Indian people claim indigenous identity. How do they play Indian? How do they act out these fantasies? And so within this context, how do Mormons then play Indian? How does that manifest itself within the construction of a Lamanite identity starting in the 19th into the 20th century? So I'll go ahead and move on to the second paper. Claire Barris's paper, I think, is very well done as a historian. I find his analysis of Kimball's memorandum book very interesting and compelling. And again, with this particular paper, I'm just going to address some comments thematically, and especially in regards to looking at the various interpretations of this lawless women revelation. So examination of the various versions of this revelation, one stands out in particular, and that was the interpretation that you titled the Spirit Version, and that provides clues as to who exactly are, you know, these lawless women. Quoting Barris's work, the phrase, quote, "those of his house" indicates these problems likely occurred in his household, and that these women would not listen to his law or would not build him up, suggests that these lawless women were disobedient wives who were not humble and would not listen to their husband, Heber Kimball. And so, again, I think you did a very good job analyzing the various interpretations of these texts, providing the historical analysis of phrases. And then, again, I think what I would encourage you to do is, as you maybe work this into maybe an article, I'm not sure what you're doing with this, but it's to provide a theoretical framework for your readers. And one I think that speaks loudly is really looking at the analysis of gender. So we look at this from, you know, Heber Kimball's perspective, but really what does that inform our understanding of notions of gender, specifically the constructions of gender as manifested by patriarchy, hierarchy, masculinity within the LDS Church, And there's quite a few readings, but one off the top I would actually recommend would be Peggy McIntosh, who does write extensively on patriarchy, also looking at white privilege and white male privilege, and I think that might fit into your work and be useful. And then also, how would the inclusion of women strengthen this essay? So what really are his wives saying, the ones that he's deeming to be lawless? Really, what are they saying about Kimball at this time? You know, if he has such a large household, is he tending to the needs of the wives, the children, or whatnot? And then finally, the notion of the lawless women that you use extends beyond the 19th century, as you have highlighted with the Temple Endowment, that really kind of changes in 1990. So I think one is that your work is very important because it highlights the leadership of Heber C. Kimball, but also the process behind the articulation of revelation regarding lawless women, and that you conclude that the theoretically patriarchal framework taught by Young and Kimball did not work well in practice, and Kimball was allowed to opt out. So again, how can we push this further? Why is it important? Is there something that we can connect to even contemporary times? And so I think this idea or this notion of lawless women, how does that reflect current tensions, I think, in criticisms of the LDS Church, whether that be, there's a recent, a few months ago, where, you know, women are wearing jeans to church, for example, or women who are arguing for, you know, receiving the priesthood. But really, does that reflect the gender tensions and the roles that are assigned to both men and women and how they see value of themselves within the LDS Church? And what happens then to these women who are deemed lawless? Are they then pushed out? You know, as Kimball does, he kind of just chooses not to deal with them in this lifetime. But again, what does that mean for women within the LDS Church today? So, thank you.
So we've got plenty of time for questions and answers. Mark?
Can we use one of the mics?
Yeah.
Except for the recording.
Where is that mic?
Hello?
Here.
We'll start with that, Mark.
This is a question for Claire. So, Claire, I think you kind of addressed this indirectly, but maybe for review. How would you articulate the law of lawless women? Like, if you were writing a law for the statutes or something.
Yeah, my microphone was... how would I articulate... You mean as... How would I interpret Kimball's law? What would I say that actually means? Is that what
yes, yes.
I think it was he was saying that they had constructed their own law. I believe it was a reversal in the kind of pyramid structure of Mormon patriarchy hierarchy, and by them not, it's kind of a top-down flow or bottom-up flow of obedience.
Right.
And that these women were not obedient, and that is, their law was basically, they were dictating to Heber, they shouldn't be doing that. So they were creating this law that really shouldn't be there, and this is what was going on.
Yeah, that's helpful. But and I can see how you can read it that way. I think that's the right reading for the most part. But it's kind of complicated because it kind of sounds like the Lord is like releasing him from it. It almost sounds like the law of Sarah in what's now D&C 132, right? Where it's this law that it is a divine law and you have to keep it, except unless there's a certain set of circumstances in which you're no longer have to keep it. So, could it just mean that regardless of their obedience, he was obligated to them, and now he isn't anymore? Or
let me say a bit. I looked at other uses of the term law, the law of the Lord, and use of law, and I found that during that time frame, there was just generic uses of like biblical quotes. The law of the Lord says this, or you shall be under the law. And there was secular law, like, oh, this person disobeyed the law, and he's, you know, because he's under the law, he should, you know, pay a penalty. But there's a very interesting use of the term law, especially the law of the Lord and the law of God. And that it actually starts, I believe, with Wilford Woodruff when he marries a couple of teenage girls on the plains. And then these girls go out and start cavorting with some teenage boys. And, of course, Wilford is furious, Brigham Young is furious. And so Hosea Stout is ordered to teach these boys the law of the Lord. And we have this term, the law, which seems to have particular meaning during this time frame. And they thought they were going to be castrated, but they didn't. But they ended up beating them. Later, this law is used in talking about race and the seed of Cain. And in fact, I was going to try to pull this in my paper, but I didn't have time. But the day before, the day after, Brigham Young preaches to the territorial legislature that the seed of Cain, it was the first time that blacks were banned from the priesthood publicly. And Young uses rhetoric about the law, and that it's kind of a strange thing that he says. He says, if I and the other top leaders of the church were to have sexual relations with the with black women, then we would be under their law, and they would have power over us, and we would not be able to be redeemed. And, you know, and basically reverse the hierarchy, like happened in Kimball. So this is like the next day. This is that same week, the same kind of rhetoric or similar rhetoric is going on about the law and two parties being reversed from the proper thing. And then he also talks about the law, about the seed of Abel, that Cain would not be able to be redeemed and come out from underneath the law until Abel and his descendants had all received the priesthood. There seems to be an inner relationship. And so I think that Kimball is kind of trying to speak the same kind of language. Later, the law of the Lord becomes a euphemism for blood atonement. They teach people blood atonement. They talk about blood atonement as if it's the law of the Lord. So that's kind of where I think the bigger context is, but it's kind of hard to prove that, pinpoint that into Kimball's revelation. But that seems to be how that terminology is used at that time frame.
Since I've got the mic, I'll use it. Then I'll hand it to this gentleman. Claire, are these documents available digitized anywhere on the Church History website?
Yes, they've recently been digitized. You can do a search for memorandum book, and they'll come up, and they have a very nice digitized version of that.
Kind of based off of what she said, I apologize, I've forgotten your name. If you look at expanding this at all, have you explored Heber C. Kimball's attitudes on women in general? Because I know he had some very negative things to say towards women. There's some quotes from the Nauvoo time period where he talks about loving Brigham Young more than he loved his wives, and how if the women didn't behave better, they're going to be banned from the temple, and some other things of this nature. Have you ever looked into just his attitude about women in general?
Yeah, I think that quote you just referred about to women being banned from the temple, I almost included that in my paper. I may be getting this right. You may remember it more than I, but he basically says that, you know, they included women in the holy order in Nauvoo, and I can't remember the reason why, but they didn't do it right. He says, we may ban women from the holy order from now on if they don't do things right. You know? So yeah, he's got a very patriarchal attitude, which I tried to get some quotes to illustrate. And I think that comes from this theology that is set up, starting with Joseph, but I think really articulated by Brigham Young when they're forming the Nauvoo temple ritual before they get kicked out and have to cross the plains. And this very patriarchal aspect comes out.
So my question is for both presenters, because it has to do with the idea of feeling a kind of self-motivation in the context of something where revelation is possible. So in the context of Dunham, are there things in which he, I mean, the question you were raising is, what exactly did Joseph Smith tell him to do, and how closely would he have followed those orders? But were there also moments where he, like he received Kimball, appears to be kind of receiving his own revelation from the Lord, and like he's going to follow through on that anyway? And the reason I ask if he received Kimball, because I think it's interesting, and you can perhaps tell us how significant this is, that the revelation comes from the Lord, not from Brigham Young, which is itself in some ways a kind of violation of the hierarchical mode of obedience that you outlined in the sort of lawless woman revelation. I mean, I have to imagine that Brigham Young and he, you know, maybe at the pub could have talked about lawless woman a lot. And why did this come from God rather than Brigham Young telling him, oh, I, by the way, law, because it was Joseph Smith that forced him into the initiation of it. What gave him the right to feel like God was telling him it was okay, as opposed to Brigham Young releasing him from the law of lawless woman?
I can't answer I can't think of any occasion when Dunham received revelation sort of in his own right. Maybe there are occasions that I'm just not remembering, but he did receive patriarchal blessings, probably from, he received at least one patriarchal blessing from Joseph Smith Sr., and then he received another sort of revelation that was sort of like a blessing from Joseph Smith, both of which really laid out that, like, he was supposed to do a set of very specific things in connection with the Indian mission. And it's interesting, the revelation that I think may have been from Joseph Smith Jr. Tells him to go to Canada, tells him that he's supposed to visit a nation of Indians, and then they're going to tell him that they already have a prophet, but then he tells them about the Mormon prophet, and then they convert. And at first they're supposed to refuse him food, but then they feed him after they accept his message. He sort of does this, but not a lot. Like he makes sort of a gesture toward obedience to this religion, but he, or this revelation, I mean. But he doesn't really go all the way. He goes to the Canada border, and on this side of the Canada border, he goes to the Tuscarora Indians, and the exchange about the prophet doesn't happen. But they do feed him, and so I think he feels like he's fulfilled this revelation enough, and now he can kind of go do his own thing. So it's interesting, you know, I think he felt like he had to obey revelation, but maybe it wasn't quite as rigid as one might expect.
As to, I think you asked, why did Brigham, as the head of the church, get the revelation for Kimball? I think that, I mean, this was over his own family, and I think the church teaches that today, that we are entitled to receive revelation for our own stewardship, and I... Kimball had a lot of revelations on his own, and I don't think that anybody chastised him for that. And I don't think he ever tried to present him as binding on the entire church. But that's kind of how I think I responded to that, despite taking it.
I'd like to make a comment. It appears to me that there's a real danger in taking what happens in these people's lives too literally as the mind and will of God. And my point is that in those days, they were sealing themselves to each other. Like Heber C. Kimball would be sealed to Brigham Young, would be sealed to Joseph Smith. Well, Wilford Woodruff receives a revelation saying this is taboo. This is wrong, you're not supposed to do that. Then he tells Brigham Young, who endorses that, and they reverse that, and that's why we have the temple ordinance work we have today. So it appears to me these guys really didn't always know what they were doing. They were groping and going forward as best they could. Would you comment on what you think regarding that?
Well, that's a good question. I think the nature of we kind of learn in church what revelation is and how it works, and I think it maybe is a little more complex. I think that there's this spirit that Joseph Smith had and continued for some time of this inquiry of what could be, and somehow that's kind of tied to maybe almost a creative process, or like, oh, we could do this, and that maybe somehow revelation is somehow a kind of a creative process with divine influence, perhaps. And so they would come with these there's this just spirit of, wow, what else can we do? Let's create, you know, let's start sealing, you know, have a spirit of the law of adoption where men are sealed to men as if they're their fathers. And, but over time, and I think it's Weber that has a theory of how religion works. I'm probably going to butcher this badly, but I believe that he says that you start with a charismatic prophet-like individual that is on fire with revelation and personality and so forth, and this ignites this new religious movement. But later, you have the priestly leaders that come in more of a priest role, not in the sense that we consider that in church, but they contain the charisma. They manage it in a manageable way so that it doesn't burn up the new religious movement. And I think maybe this is still part of that creative phase, but later it becomes more contained. Hopefully that answered your question.
If memory serves, one of the times that when Brigham Young said that he wasn't like Joseph and he didn't receive revelations, he left that to Heber, because Heber was always having these spiritual manifestations that Brigham didn't pretend to. But I have a question. When did Heber start marrying plural wives again? And what was the year of this revelation?
The revelation was in 1852, and I have to put my chart up to remember the exact dates, but it's in 1845-46, that winter, it's the Nauvoo Temple is, they have to leave in the spring, they're being kicked out. Heber C. Kimball literally, when he does this 3-day mega marrying thing, it's literally Brigham Young, as I recall, Brigham Young has said, well, we're closing the temple. We have to leave. And the saints are saying, no, we need another day. And so he says, all right, we'll keep the temple open another day. And I believe that's the day that he marries these 10 wives, the most he ever marries. And then he marries two more the next day, and then five the next day. So I mean, he barely misses he almost missed the boat on this. But you want to know what precisely about the marriages, what he...
When was the revelation?
1852. And he seems to pick up again when the Reformation starts. He undergoes this big, long dearth of no marriages, and then in 1856, I think it was, that he adds another wife or two wives, and then the next year he adds another one. So I think that was possibly Reformation related. That's my guess.
I just wonder if perhaps part of the lawlessness of these women were in opposition to his taking more wives, even more wives, which he didn't for a number of years. And also it might relate to the fact that he provided very little for these women in terms of food and other necessities. These women and all of their children, they basically supported themselves and probably complained about that figure.
I'm sure that is the case.
There was a comment about the law of Sarah, and I noticed that too, the similarity, and I wondered how likely you think it is that that was just his terminology for the law of Sarah. The law of lawless woman may have been the law of Sarah, and that's what he was terming it. What do you think about that?
I had not even considered that. I'm going to go home and read that and see what I think. That's a great idea, and I hadn't really thought of that, so I appreciate the prompt to approve it.
There are some great comments. It's very, very exciting, very interesting. I was thinking that there might be some irony involved in this as well. We don't know what the final shape of the endowment ceremony was, as given by Joseph Smith. And there's a lot of additional work done on that ritual following the death of the prophet, you know, prior to its administration in the temple. And so you may have been hinting at this yourself, but I think there's some irony in the fact that the language that women should obey the law of their husbands may have come from Brigham Young and Peter C. Kimball themselves, as they are fashioned the final form of that ritual for the saints in Nauvoo. I just wanted to point that out. That seemed kind of ironic that he's having this issue when he himself may have been the architect of that language. So.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good point. They were to obey their husband's law. Yeah, I think it took me a while to find that, but I realized, hey, this that seems to be related to what they covenanted. And what I don't know, maybe somebody here knows, can help me, is for plural marriages, I don't know if they took the same oath or not. I don't know if it was out of the temple, if they would still come in to obey the law of their husband. If somebody knows that, I'd love you to come up and fill me in on that.
I have a question for Christopher C. Smith. What's the date on the Lee document? How's that? How recent was that from the time he transcribed it?
That was during his trial when he was in prison. That's in the Confessions of John Daly book that he gave to his lawyer, I think it was. I'm not sure what the date on that, but it was late. It was like 30 years afterward or something like that.
Didn't you say there was two versions of it, though?
So the Confessions book is where he says he attributes it to Dunham. And then the other version is also from the lawyer. It's from the same source, but it's published in a newspaper, and it's framed as, this is some additional material that didn't make it into the book. And so it's kind of just a different version of the same telling.
Could you give I don't think you said this, I'm just kind of curious what happened to them. Did he save the saints? Just kind of like quick, what happened to him after Joseph Smith? I think Joseph Smith.
So, yeah, that's actually a wonderful question, which I didn't get to in my paper, although I wanted to, I just didn't have enough space for it. There is a story that he was, he actually committed suicide because he was so depressed about this. This is what Quinn argues, is that Dunham was so sort of depressed about not having rescued Joseph Smith from the jail that he asked, when he was out on a mission to the Indians with Louis Dana, he asked Louis Dana to kill him, and Louis Dana did, and Louis Dana buried the body. There's only one source that says this, and Quinn actually gets it a little bit wrong. What the source says is that Joseph Smith had asked Dunham to fortify the city, which I think in this context probably means Nauvoo, not Carthage, although it could mean Carthage. It could mean that it could be a reference to wanting to guard the jail. But I interpret it as Smith wanted Dunham to fortify Nauvoo, and they were just going to fight it out rather than turning themselves in, which is what they did. And that Dunham was so depressed that he hadn't done that, that he asked Louis Dana to kill him. This is in 1845, by the way. This is like a year and a month after the martyrdom. I found five or six other sources that say that Dunham was actually murdered by the Danites. Some of these sources, the earliest one is from 1846, and it actually says that he was murdered because Brigham Young wanted him to give up his authority to pursue the Indian mission, which he refused to do. I don't really buy that story because there are lots of other people doing the Indian mission under Brigham Young's authorization at the same time. So I don't think that that's a plausible motivation. But other versions of this murder story suggest that he was murdered because of his failure to follow Joseph Smith's orders. And so this is sort of in the air very early, as early as 1846, and then continuing well into the late 19th century. And I don't actually buy the murder story, because the murder story says that Dunham and Dana were out on this mission, and then Dana, they got alone, and as soon as they were alone, Dana killed Dunham. And all of the versions of this story get details wrong. They're all framed as sort of rumor. None of them give any provenance for this information, except that Dunham died under suspicious circumstances. And I think maybe the suicide story is actually just sort of an apologetic version of the murder story, that it's just a way of accepting the sort of historicity of the story, but getting rid of the negative connotations of it. So ultimately, I think this is probably a rumor that was circulated. I think Dunham probably died of natural causes. The official explanation that ends up in Daniel Spencer's journal and Brigham Young's journal is that Dunham died of dysentery or typhoid or something like that. And so that's most likely what happened to him. But Louis Dana was known to make comments about killing people who had been involved in Joseph's murder. On one occasion, one of the murderers was on his way to be indicted, and Dana followed him, and according to one of his fellow Danites, he was staring at the guy, and the guy said, "Why are you staring at me?" And he said, "I'm marking you with my eyes so that I can kill you if I ever meet you alone in the woods," which is interesting because he's supposed to have supposedly killed Dunham when they were alone in the woods. But I don't accept the murder story largely because they were in the woods for a long time by themselves before this is supposed to have happened. They were out there for several months on this Indian mission, and Dana doesn't seem to kill him until several months into it. So I don't really buy the idea that he killed him. Or, yeah.
Do we have any others?
Do any of you guys care to respond to? Oh yeah, sorry.
Just a quick comment on the marriage and gender dynamics. In the recent biography of Amasa Lyman by Leo Lyman, you have some of this, and I think Lyman marries maybe 16 wives or so, or at least a dozen, and he has trouble with his large household. Okay. And then in the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, which isn't quite 12 during this story period all the time, he's in this small group of men with quite a bit of unity. And so it's just a very different social dynamic. You know, I think of my own marriage with my wife. I only have one wife. We're very close. And so we have this kind of companionate relationship. Whereas, and Amasa Lyman makes this comment to his brother in the Quorum of the Twelve. He says, you know, I've got all these wives and I've had trouble with half of them, but I'm in perfect harmony with you, my brother, and I love you more than my wives. It's not what you would normally think, that you would love some man more than you would love your wife, but it's just a very different social dynamic. Where, you know, he's meeting regularly with his brother in the Quorum of the Twelve, and he's in harmony with this small group of men, and they have this strong brotherhood and companionship. It becomes a stronger love, a stronger relationship, companionship, and love than he has with his wife. So it is a very different social order.
Just to note on that, I did notice Heber loved his first wife, Violet, dearly. There's these love letters. I mean, they just were totally committed. So it's almost like you love the brother and you love your first wife, and then it kind of maybe dwindles. And his second wife, I believe it was Sarah New. It's interesting to read some letters from Violet. Violet will write, and then she'll leave some space for the second wife, Sarah New, to write. It's a little more formalistic. You can tell there's a lot more warmth with Violet and less warmth. But nevertheless, it's kind of fun to watch Violet accommodate Sarah writing to Heber. And, you know, anyway, it, kind of along these lines. But I think it quickly drops off after you have so many wives. like you said, it's a very different social dynamic. And how do you develop a personal relationship with them while you're trying to run a church?
Well, I think we'll close it up then. Thank you so much for coming, and thanks for the presenters and responses.